there we have it. Major upset in French political history. Emmanuel Macron, the centrist newcomer, arrives on top, 23.7% of the vote, ahead of Marine Le Pen, 21.7% of the vote. This means that for the first time ever in the history of the Fifth Republic, the two mainstream parties are eliminated after round one.
The challenge is going to be to break away to the very end, away from a system that has been incapable of actually answering the problems besetting this country for more than 30 years already. The challenge is therefore to start writing a whole new page in the political history of our country and to make sure that everyone with justice and with efficiency will be able to play the role that is theirs in France and in Europe. That is our challenge.
You have allowed me to take part in the second round of the presidential campaign, and it's an honor for me, and I accept it with humility and appreciation. So now it's my responsibility to free the French people of arrogance who want to dictate its behavior, because yes, I am the candidate of the people.
WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the program. Today is Monday. It's April 24th, 2017, 5:11 in the morning. Glad to have you along. A start of another business week, another business day unfolding in front of us. Lots to talk about this morning. A little bit later on in the program, we'll dive into some crime figures from across the country and right here in Chicago. We'll see how big of an impact Chicago's crime numbers have in the overall nationwide numbers and what might we do to change that. That'll be coming up in the second half of the program today. First, we begin at the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk. A strong morning in Europe today. You heard in the opening montage the two winning candidates who will move on to the runoff election in France, the pro-EU centrist Emmanuel Macron, who is expected to beat right-wing rival Marine Le Pen in the vote next month, May 7th. Macron is a pro-business candidate. Very popular there. Polls show him far ahead. Of course, we know how polls work, but right now that's what's buoying the markets in France this morning. Looking at the numbers in Europe, the CAC in France is up almost 4.5%, gaining 216 points. The DAX is up about 3 points. In Germany, 344 points. Even the FTSE's higher this morning, up about 2%, 127 points. Higher this morning. Here in this country, we're looking for a positive open as well. Look at this. Dow futures up 199 points, almost a full percent this morning. S&P futures up a percent as well. NASDAQ futures right there behind with a percent higher as well. Looks like a nice positive open when Wall Street opens up later this morning. Crude oil trading 50.03 a barrel, up almost a percent as well. Gold is lower. Silver is lower as well. Look at Asian markets real quick. Even green numbers there. The Nikkei up almost a percent and a half. 255 points. The Hang Seng is up a half a percent. Generally positive numbers in Asia as well. The dollar gained against the yen, weakened against the euro after that election in France. We'll obviously be talking more about the French election as the week goes along, but this victory for Macron has put all of these numbers in France higher today. Again, traders there and around the world excited about his pro-business stance. Still a lot to learn about him. He's a newcomer to French politics and world politics, so we'll see how that plays out. We have a couple of other stories we're watching this morning. Business economists generally optimistic about the U.S. economy, with most expecting stronger growth than last year's poor performance. Economists surveyed by the National Association for Business Economics also expected improved or unchanged sales profits at their companies in the second quarter. Most reporting no changes in hiring or investment in response to policy changes expected after the November election. And we may have to wait a little longer for the next iPhone. There's a report out in some of the tech trades this morning. It may be delayed months. We'll find out more about that maybe later on today. So are you healthy emotionally and physically? It is part of a good workplace. Helps you succeed there on the job. The mission statement at Interactive Health, based in Schaumburg, is to create healthy companies by improving employee health, and that means emotional and physical health. In the CEO spotlight this morning, Kathy Kenworthy, the CEO of Interactive Health. Kathy, good morning, and welcome to the opening bell.
Good morning, Steve. Thanks for having me.
So glad to have you with us this morning because I think, you know, if you're like me, if people are like me, you get up in the morning, the first thing you think about is health, and you want to be happy and well. Do you wake up with sort of that sense every morning as well?
I do. I think that's a very human thing. What's possible for today?
Yeah. And do you sort of do a, I don't know, take a snapshot of all of those things before you get going in the morning? Or should we be doing that and say, hey, okay, I need to do this today to be happy, or I need to do this today to be well?
I really enjoy early morning time, and I do use it to read and take in information. I probably am not thinking quite as much about specific goals for the day in terms of being healthy or happy, but I have certain routines in terms of things that get my head ready for the day. So
you're an early morning person?
Very much so.
I've heard and seen a lot of different takes on this, that people who wake up early in the morning, we are among those, often do better, that they get more accomplished. Is there any truth to those studies?
I can't say that I know that for sure. But I do think having at least some period of time, some people are late night owls, some are early morning, you know, times in a very busy existence that we all have with lots of information coming at us in this age of social media from lots of places, just some component of a day where you can gather yourself, tune in to what's going on for you and be ready for what's coming at you, I think is important for everybody.
Mm. Tell us about interactive health.
So interactive health is, you may read of and hear about mission-driven companies. Interactive health is a mission-driven company. We believe in both altruism and capitalism with regard to health. We work with employers and are hired by employers to help employees be healthier. And we do that in a very specific way. And we've been doing that for actually coming up on 25 years. So we've been at it for quite a while. And what we do, Steve, is we believe that information is power. People knowing in a specific way what is their health and then being curious and engaged in their health in a quantified way is a huge motivator of improving health. We're probably not the only company that thinks that health risk prevention is a good thing to do, but we do have a very specific way of thinking about it.
And so how is that? How is that that you do that?
Sure.
The quantitative part of it.
Sure. So we will engage hands-on, on-site, in the workplace, help individuals in a very private way, gather information about their health, and then we'll actually take blood, and we'll use that information in combination to apply what we know about prediabetes, hypertension, heart disease, anemia, a wide range of topics. And we don't diagnose, we don't treat, but we help people in a specific way understand and identify potential health risks. And then we encourage those individuals to spend time with a physician, but do it in a way where the individual is empowered, has information. We assign a score with regard to somebody's health as well as a goal that's specific to that individual.
The empowered part of that is important because those of us who go visit our doctors regularly, sometimes we don't feel that at all. You feel like you're sort of a, you know, cattle in a corral. Why is that important to be empowered?
You know, there's been so much written about consumerism, and I believe in consumerism, but I believe in empowered and knowledgeable consumerism, that if you're informed, you're going to make better decisions. And whether it's technology, whether it's you know, almost any means that we have today to make improvements in the kinds of decisions, I think information is part of that. It creates confidence. It creates the ability to actually have a conversation. And I think physicians welcome that, honestly. We get very good feedback from physicians who have participants who show up with maybe even a trend chart about what's been happening with their blood pressure over a period of time, not just one snapshot. People who have the opportunity to read in a layman's terms information about, you know, what are sometimes complicated piece of information about high cholesterol. Mm. Empowered also means that people actually know what's going on with their health. When we work with these populations, Steve, the great majority, even people who think they're doing the right thing, are actually not informed about their health. When I first joined Interactive Health, I participated in a health evaluation and I thought, oh, well, I know what's going on with my health and I'll just do this so I have the experience. And I learned that there was something that I was not aware of, that my physician was not aware of, that was part of my health situation. So I think the idea of having information both allows it to be acted upon, but I think it actually motivates action.
Mm-hmm. And also that empowerment, too, you sort of take ownership of it. And if you fail or pass, it's on you at that point.
Right. And you know, we believe very passionately that everybody should have resources to help them get there. So, yes, accountable, but also help and support to get there. But I think there has been an era, at least in the worksite wellness space, where there's been a view of paternalism. We'll tell people what to do. And I think that's misguided. I think in our day and age, it should not be, generally speaking, paternalistic. It should be, hey, the accountability for your health and the possibilities in your life are very impacted by your ability to be healthy.
This notion of well-being and overall health, it's not just physical health, is it?
Correct.
Is it not?
Correct. We have such a large data set. Our information is actually 3 million individual participants over 25 years. We've worked with quite literally millions of individual employers as well. And we're using that information to learn about a whole range of pretty fascinating topics, one of the most important of which is the connection between physical and emotional health. We've been measuring, and we have a statistically valid way of posing questions that allow us to understand risk of depression, risk of anxiety, risk of stress, risk of different issues that are important. How is somebody's sleep health? And we're learning a lot about how do depression and diabetes connect to one another? How does anxiety and hypertension connect to one another? And so we certainly believe that attention to emotional health is a huge part of better physical health, and attention to physical health is a huge enabler of emotional health.
Taking the measure of all of this stuff, it sounds really comprehensive. Do you ever get folks who are worried about handing over that much information about themselves?
For sure. I think privacy with regard to worksite wellness is a very, very valid, extremely important topic, and something that we do a lot of work to set people's minds at ease in terms of, you know, we're governed by regulations. We are very, very private in terms of how this information is handled with regard to the employer. We are scrupulous about that. But I think it's an extremely fair question. And I think it's something that, I think there have been studies done in terms of, you know, there's disclosures that people sign, and you could write almost anything in the middle of the disclosure and people sign it without, yeah, you know, obviously not reading it. Read the disclosures. Make sure that if you're involved in a program like ours, that you understand whether that provider believes they can sell your information to a third party, whether they believe they can, which we do not. Mm. Look at that carefully and be sure you're involved in a responsible program.
So you will earn the trust then of people who are participating, because there are some who would think that maybe that information would be used against them in the workplace in some way. That's not how you guys operate.
We don't operate. And by the way, I really do relate to and understand why people are worried about that. It's not something we've seen at issue with any employer that we've worked with. I think most employers are sensitive to that issue as well. But I do think it's valid, and it's something that it's worth reflecting on and making sure, as I say, that you're working in a responsible program.
Getting to see all those data points, as you mentioned, the millions of them.
Right.
What would you say are the biggest health problems, the biggest wellness problems or impacts that are affecting people these days?
So I personally am really zeroed in on three areas. One is prediabetes, one is hypertension, and one is emotional health. Prediabetes, the American Medical Association indicates that 90 million Americans have prediabetes, and 90% of them do not know, of those individuals do not know that they have prediabetes. Prediabetes can be reversed, mm-hmm. and it is probably one of the most tangible and specific exemplars of what good preventive health efforts can look like. It's a very expensive thing to be diabetic. Mm-hmm. It's a health condition that complicates almost every other element of one's life. And I think it's sort of the smoking of this generation. Mm-hmm. I really believe in terms of really undertaking much more aggressive interventions around identifying prediabetes and helping people pull back from it. Hypertension is one that is very closely second in my mind to prediabetes. It's also one with a staggering number of Americans who have hypertension. Again, it's silent. There's no necessary, obvious evidence of being hypertensive. And it's one where the science is extremely well understood in terms of how to correct hypertension, yet the risk of stroke and all kinds of issues are the definite outcome of hypertension left to develop on its own. So that's a big topic. And then emotional health, as we talked about, I mean, I think there are, and what's interesting in our data, Steve, is that the incidence of emotional risk is much higher at younger ages, and particularly among women. Mm-hmm. And it is something that concerns me, that the younger women in the early part of their career, 20s and 30s, are being told, you know, you can have it all. And it turns out it's hard to have it all. And so I can't say for sure I know that's what the driver is there. Maybe mm-hmm. we all just somehow get happier as we get older. And maybe it's always been that way. But I think those are three topics that are well worth every employer's attention.
It also seems recently when the workplace, I know here on the opening bell, we've reported on it a couple of times, that the lack of sleep for workers is also a big deal.
It is a big deal.
How big of a deal that are you seeing?
Well, the sleep health issues are clearly and obviously correlated to prediabetes and some of the other topics that I talked about. So it goes with many of these topics. I think there is a tremendous amount, like whereas I said on hypertension, the science of how to correct for hypertension is extremely well understood. I don't know that I'm as convinced in sleep health that we really know for sure how to impact it. There are sleep health techniques. There's a favorite one I have that's helped me quite a bit. That's called the 4, I won't get this quite right, but something like the 4-8-7 technique. And it's a breathing pattern where you breathe in for a certain set of counts, mm-hmm. you hold your breath for a certain set of counts, and then you release your breath, and it kind of triggers the relaxation mechanisms in your body. So there are, I think, small things that can go a long way towards sleep health, but I think the long-term impacts of sleep health on health period are very important.
How do you personally impact the culture at your company? You've mentioned a couple of times things that you do in your life that help you, that guide you. How do those go over as with your employees? How do you maybe influence your employees with those areas?
Yeah, it's a great question, Steve. Our company, as I mentioned, is mission-driven, and we have an incredibly caring group of employees. We only work, by the way, through our own employees. So when we go on site to an employer's work site, and we work, you know, all over the country from Alaska to Florida and everywhere in between. So our individuals travel, they're extremely caring, and they're very dedicated. And sometimes we are, as caregivers, the last ones to think about our own health. So I do spend quite a bit of time. We have a very generous vacation policy. We have a very generous set of benefits overall. We have our own worksite wellness program that has very high levels of participation, as you might imagine. But it's something where silence is not an option. As a leader, I feel like putting words to and demonstrating to others the actions I take and the actions I'm inviting others to take to care for themselves as part of this is, I think, something I try very hard to make sure is clear.
What challenges do you face as the CEO of this company?
My ambition for the company is that I have a favorite saying, not every business in America does business with us yet. And I believe that every single company in America could benefit from working with Interactive Health. We work with every size employer. We work with shipbuilders in Newport News to private equity here in Chicago to every kind of business function that you can imagine. And employers spend half the healthcare dollars in this country. So these are, you know, the connection between better health and more economic spend, I have a lot of energy around. That said, scaling for that growth and achieving that growth in a way that's sustainable, that is based on good process and is based on not heroism in the middle of the night, but, you know, really thoughtful planning for what we want that growth to look like, that's a huge challenge for me as a leader of the company.
I'm sure you've been watching the stuff going on in Washington with the healthcare law and the repeal and replace. Do you have any thoughts on that? And what direction would you like to maybe see that go?
I think it ties directly, Steve, to our conversation before about empowerment and accountability just at the employer level. I think if anybody is looking to Washington to sort of handle the topic of healthcare, we might want to think again. I think when we reflect on the fact that employers spend half the healthcare dollars in this country, spending those dollars wisely to plan for and implement effective preventive care health management programs are clearly a way to make, and we have all kinds of data, given the size and scope of the data that I mentioned before, to unquestionably prove that people knowing what their health risks are, identifying those health risks, engaging with their personal physician is the path. And so I think we, I will compliment the Affordable Care Act. I mean, I think it triggered in the private sector a lot of innovation, and there are some incredibly fascinating things happening broadly in healthcare that I think can all, at least have the potential to play a role in the large solution. But I certainly believe in private sector.
Yeah, at the very basic level, what the Affordable Care Act did was, even for people who were not sick or are not sick, they've started going to the doctor. They've started getting to check up and seeing their gauging their health. That has to be a good thing.
I couldn't agree more.
Yeah. So let's end the interview with this. I want to get a sense of if there's been a wow moment in your career, or what was it that Oprah always liked to call it, that yeah moment or that yes moment. What would that be, and what could you share with our listeners?
Sure. So I've benefited from the opportunity to do a lot of different things in my career, and it always comes down to the moment of personal connection, the moment, the sense of an individual feeling like something more is possible in their life than was true before I had an opportunity to engage with that person. And there was a really powerful testimonial that we received from an individual that we worked with. I actually works in a senior living nursing home organization. This woman's name is Rhonda, and what she talked about in her testimonial was the identification of health issues that she hadn't been aware of, and the way our team helped her make changes in her health. But the phrase that has always stuck with me, and this is a couple of years ago, is that she said she learned she was worth fighting for. And the power of that statement, that she learned that she was worth fighting for, and her testimonial was about trying to encourage others to believe that they're worth fighting for, that their health is worth fighting for, was such a powerful expression, and it's one that I hope we can continue to live up to.
Yeah, that's something that I might use when I wake up tomorrow morning.
Yeah.
Yeah, very nice. Kathy, good to meet you, and good luck.
Thank you, Steve.
Kathy Kenworthy is the CEO of Interactive Health, based in Schaumburg. We're going to continue our conversation with Kathy after the bell, and we'll post it to our podcast of The Opening Bell later this morning at WGNradio.com. And you can check more out about Interactive Health online at interactivehealthinc.com.
Now, WGN Radio's daily conversation about the life of business and the business of life. This is The Opening Bell with Steve Grzanich on 720 WGN.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome back to the program. It's 5:41. A new report highlights increases in crime in specific cities, including Chicago. It is put together by the New York University School of Law at Brennan Center, the Justice Program. And we have with us one of the co-authors of this 20-year crimes trend study today, Ames Grart, again, from the Brennan Center Justice Program at NYU School of Law. Ames, good morning. Welcome to The Opening Bell.
Hey, good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
Glad to have you on. This is, very important to all of us. Obviously, here in Chicago, we follow this very, very carefully. What are the headlines from your study?
Sure. So the two big takeaways is that if you look at where crime rates are today across the country and in most big cities compared to 25 years ago, it's just night and day. In 1991, the crime rate was near historic highs. Today in the country and most cities are near historic lows. The big caveat to that is there are some cities that have seen crime go up, but it looks to us more like highly localized changes. You mentioned Washington, D.C. and Baltimore have both seen crime increase in recent years, but they look to be falling back to earth, which is great. Chicago, however, as I'm sure you all are aware, is dealing with what looks like an increase in murders.
The headline with Chicago there is even more startling when you get into some of the data. According to your report, Chicago alone responsible for almost half, 43% increase in urban murders last year. That's pretty significant.
It is. So let me give you some more detail on that. We study a group of the 30 largest cities that to us are representative of big cities as a whole. So out of that group, Chicago accounted for around half of the increase in 2016. And that is, it's startling. It suggests that even in big cities that are dealing with crime, it's not that much has changed, with the exception of Chicago. And what that suggests to us is there's some very serious local problems that I'm sure you all are aware of. And if we get into even grainier detail, it looks more like a neighborhood-by-neighborhood problem, too.
Yeah, so that's the big next question, and that is, what's causing it? What could be done to maybe turn this around?
So we're looking into that. It's a question we've had for a while. So when we did a similar report to this last year, Chicago, Baltimore, and D.C. were collectively responsible for more than half of the increase in murder in our group of cities. So it's something we've had in our mind for a while. No findings yet, but we're gathering some data. And the surprising thing we found, just in what we've been doing so far, is that if you look at neighborhood by neighborhood, there are parts of Chicago that are as safe as they've ever been, even maybe safer, and there are parts of Chicago that are significantly more dangerous. And what it looks to us like is, if you look in cities across the country and their experience, cities struggling with poverty, with segregation, with lack of economic opportunity, generally have a harder time with crime. And what we think is happening is that these neighborhoods are suffering the same problems.
You know, as we report often here on WGN, it seems that gangs and guns are two of the things that always come up when we talk about those. Yeah. From your early study, is that what you're seeing as well?
It is, actually. So this is something that I think will merit a lot more research by us and by many people. But one thing that we found that's interesting is, you know, in New York, where I am, it's a city with tough gun laws surrounded by states with tough gun laws. In Chicago and Illinois, it's a city with tough gun laws surrounded by states that don't necessarily have the same restrictions. So it's a little easier to traffic in guns, and we think that might be driving some of the increase in crime. But there's still some more research to be done there, so I don't want to offer preliminary conclusions as a certainty yet.
Yeah, but you bring up a good argument or a good case for this. We've actually been starting to address that now, finally, in Illinois with some tougher gun laws. But what I hear you saying is that it really may not have a big impact unless Indiana and Missouri and Wisconsin, all those other states that are around us, get their act together, too.
I think that's right, but, you know, every little bit helps. If it's easier, if there's more of a concerted effort to recover guns that have been trafficked in Illinois, I think you'll start to see some change in Chicago. The other thing we've seen is we did a report 2 years or so ago on what caused crime rates to decline across the country. And one of the conclusions will not be too surprising from that more police officers doing a better job engaging with their communities are very effective at bringing down crime. So more cops in Chicago walking the beat and getting to know the people they work with would do a world of difference, too.
And not only that, but it sounds to me like this report, your study, suggests, too, that if it's a neighborhood-by-neighborhood problem, that police resources might be channeled into those areas to solve problems.
That's also absolutely correct. In that same report, we looked at cities that have used CompStat or similar data-driven policing programs to figure out where officers are needed and send them there. And that's made a world of difference in New York. I'm sure it's made a world of difference in Chicago, but maybe tend to redouble those efforts.
Ames, I know that part of your background, too, is understanding the cost of crime. What are these numbers? If you had to translate them into dollars and cents impact, how is it affecting Chicago?
Sure. So this is something we're working on in the longer term. We want to try to understand how much over-incarceration, how much the criminal justice system impacts local economies. And I think it's probably fair to say, even at this fairly preliminary phase, that if you have more people falling victim to crimes in certain Chicago neighborhoods, more people cycling in and out of jail or prison, then it contributes to a cycle of poverty that it's really hard to break. It means crime leads to poverty, poverty leads to crime. It'll take a concerted effort from local leaders to break that cycle. And the same is true in neighborhoods across the country. It's definitely not just Chicago, but I know that's something that many cities struggle with. Yeah.
Are we talking about costs that are in the billions of dollars for cities like Chicago?
I think it wouldn't be too hard to get there. So if you... It's interesting that the people who are involved in the criminal justice system are disproportionately poorer. There's no other way to say it. It's the crimes of opportunity lead to violence, lead to more incarceration. So when you remove wage earners from those communities, it can start to add up over time. And just as a percentage point, remove more and more of that community's productive potential from those streets.
Mm-hmm.
I think you could get the billion.
Yeah. And I know that just to close out here, I know that a lot of folks who are working on this daily with blood, sweat, and tears sometimes feel a sense of hopelessness in terms of solving this problem. But what I'm hearing you saying is that it is solvable.
I think so, but it's definitely going to take time. Like there are communities across the country, in New York as well, that were some of the poorest, some of the most troubled in the country. And one of them is Park Slope in Brooklyn. It was a very dangerous place in the 70s and 80s. It's now the sort of home of hipsterdom in Brooklyn. So these are problems that can be addressed by local leaders, by communities over the long term.
Ames, thank you very much for being with us this morning and sharing the results of this study. Appreciate you taking your time out.
Thank you. It was a pleasure to join.
Thank you. Ames Grauert is with the New York University School of Law at the Brennan Center's Justice Program, co-author of this 20-year crime study. We're going to link this out to you so you can take a look at all of the details, and you can also check it out at BrennanCenter.org.
You're listening to The Opening Bell on 720 WGN.
Good morning. Welcome back to the program on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk this morning. Dow futures looking positive for the open later this morning, up about 204 points right now. That's a full percent. Same story over at the S&P and NASDAQ. Gold is trading lower. Silver trading lower as well. European markets are way higher this morning. The CAC in France after the election, they're up almost 5% this morning as we head toward the opening bell. A couple of other stories we're watching for you. The average price of gasoline, regular grade gasoline, jumped 3 cents nationally over the past 2 weeks to $2.46. Industry analyst Trilby Lundberg of the Lundberg Survey says consumers could see price increases slow as crude oil posts drop. New York billionaire Michael Bloomberg says he wants to help save an international agreement to reduce carbon emissions. The former New York City mayor addressed his intensifying focus on climate change in an interview with the Associated Press. Last week, he released a new book called Climate of Hope, How Cities, Businesses, and Citizens Can Save the Planet, co-authored by former Sierra Club executive director Carl Pope. Trump administration debating whether or not to abandon the Paris Climate Accord. Bloomberg, the former mayor, is urging countries to ignore that and to continue on with their climate change efforts. Now, on the WGN Associated Bank Market Desk Outlook for this Monday, April 24th, 2017, no major economic reports, but the Senate will vote on the nomination of Sonny Perdue to be Secretary of Agriculture, followed by a vote on a motion to invoke cloture on the nomination of Rod Rosenstein to be Deputy Attorney General. All of that is happening today. There will also be a pot protest at Congress. Cannabis supporters are gathering on the Capitol to not only smoke marijuana, but urge Congress to remove it from the Controlled Substance Act. Here in Chicago, President Obama makes his first public appearance. A speech is scheduled at the University of Chicago. The National Association of Broadcasting Hall of Fame induction ceremony happens today. And the world's most prestigious awards for grassroots environmentalists are handed out today, the Environmental Prize Awards. Some of the things that could move the markets on this Monday, April 24th.